Good morning, everybody. I'd like to welcome you to the U.S. Institute of Peace. My name is Jason Gluck, and I am a senior rule of law advisor here at the Institute. I also head up USIP's constitution-making program. Some of the work that we do within the constitution-making program includes aspects of constitution-making and the processes that go into it, some substantive issues, particularly regarding federalism and power-sharing, and then we do geographic work in areas such as Iraq and Sudan. Today's event is actually a convergence of a lot of the work that the Institute has done and continues to do. We have an event, as you know, Constitutionalism in Africa, which is celebrating USIP's work in Africa, even beyond constitution-making, and we'll have a few words about that in a moment. USIP's constitution-making program, and most specifically the recent publication of the book Framing the State in Times of Transition, Case Studies in Constitution-Making, edited by Laurel Miller. What we'd like to do today is using this book as a springboard, as well as the wealth of personal experience and expertise by our esteemed panel that I'll introduce in a moment. We want to explore recent developments in constitution-making in several African nations, including Kenya, Zimbabwe, and Eritrea, and try and uncover some of the lessons learned from these experiences, where African constitutionalism is headed, whether there is, in fact, such a thing as African constitutionalism, as separate from constitutionalism more generally, and what we might expect to see in the future. Very briefly, you all, when you came in, had an opportunity to take a handout with the bios of our esteemed panel, and I will not belabor it by spending the next 45 minutes going through all the accolades and achievements that they have, in fact, accomplished. But immediately to my left, we have Professor Selassie, Professor Ndulo, Professor Prempeh, and Laurel Miller, the editor of the volume Framing the State. They all, as you can see from the paper, have just a rich, rich experience in Africa, in constitution making, and I'm very excited to what we'll hear from them today. I'm equally excited, I should say, before I was a staff member at USIP and I would come to events here, it was always exciting to see the kind of panelists that USIP would draw. Having since been at the Institute for a couple years, I've now come to realize that just as rich and exciting and interesting are the people who actually attend these events, you in the room today. And so we will have a lot of time after opening remarks for question, answer, and discussion. And while I will impress upon everyone the need to keep your comments brief, we are indeed excited to hear from you as well. The last thing I'll say is if you would please turn BlackBerries, pagers, cell phones, I guess pagers don't exist anymore, and other technologies that are beyond me in at least a vibrating position, that would be appreciated. And with that, I will ask my colleague Dorina Biko to say a few words.
Thanks. I'm actually with the Center for Conflict Analysis and Prevention here at the Institute, and I work on Africa. And we're partnering with the Rule of Law on this program. So what I wanted to do is just kind of give you some idea of why or how constitution making plays within the work that that we do here. Certainly, it's not an abstract concept. We work on in Kenya, Zimbabwe. We also work in Nigeria and Cote d'Ivoire. And you really see on the ground how issues of citizenship and identity and land rights and the whole process of constitution-making have impacted violence on the ground, whether that's election-related violence or political transition-related violence. And so that's really why, that's how we see sort of constitution in our programs. I don't really want to sort of take up any more time because we have quite a full panel, so I'm going to just turn it over to Professor Selassie, who will give us some perspectives on Eritrea.
Thank you, Dorina. I would like, first of all, to thank the Peace Institute for organizing this event and for inviting me to give my views on constitutionalism in Africa, building the foundation for Africa's democracy. The Peace Institute has been in the forefront, not only in conflict resolution, but also in exploring principles and mechanisms that would lead to, first of all, to avoid conflicts and where they exist, to resolve them. And one of the ways that the Institute thought for this to be done was to organize a working group on constitutionalism and constitution making throughout the world. I was privileged to have been asked by the Institute in 2001 to head the group that worked on the formula for creating a framework for constitution making, to explore a group of countries that have been involved in constitution making. And we started with a few countries and then we kept expanding to 19, representing throughout the entire globe, from Africa, Latin America, Asia, and Europe. For me, it was indeed a distinct honor and privilege to have been asked to chair a distinguished group of constitutional lawyers and political scientists. My group represents the who is who in that field, from some of the most renowned universities and in other institutions in the United States and elsewhere. Starting in January of 2001, we went on up to the end of 2004. It was a very extended work. It was very exciting. As we started, they asked me to start the process by writing a paper on Eritrea. I happen to have been the chairman of the Constitutional Commission of Eritrea, and I wrote the paper, which appears as a chapter, one of the chapters on Africa in the book. Secondly, I would like to single out a person who has made a magnificent work, nothing short of monumental, in analyzing and synthesizing the work that appears in the book. I'm referring, of course, to Laurel Miller, who is sitting at the edge of the table here. You will find out, as I hope you will buy the book, what I am talking about. Extremely impressive piece of work to be able to synthesize all those chapters and put them in the form of a conclusion, which is extraordinary. As we all know by now, this event is marked, if not caused by, the publication of the book. May I have the book, please? I'm now acting as your publicity agent. This is the book. I think every professor of constitutional law and comparative constitutional law will be using this book, as well as practitioners, those involved in the drafting of constitutions. It represents the entire world community, Africa, Asia, Western Asia anyway, Iraq and Afghanistan, Latin America, Europe. The issues explored in this book are varied and interesting. Perhaps we will be talking about some of them in the course of this morning. Of the several interesting, wonderful blurbs that appear on the flap of this book, my favorite, because of its concise nature, is that of Mark Tushnet, who happened to be a member of the group, of the working group, professor at the time of Georgetown, professor of law at Georgetown. Now he has moved further north to Harvard. I don't know why, but he is now at Harvard, Professor Mark Tushnet. He says, the enlightening case studies and overviews essays in this impressive collection show how modern constitution drafters face common problems and arrive at quite different solutions, some successful and others not so, all set in the precise political context the drafters face. The book is sure to be an essential resource for all those interested in constitutional development and regime transitions. Common problems faced by drafters include: how do we accommodate different ethnic and religious groups within the same constitutional framework? How do we frame the rights and liberties of people and balance them with the powers of governments? Above all, in areas that have just come out from conflicts, as the case of Eritrea was, and Zimbabwe, and South Africa, what kind of issues do constitutional drafters face in drafting constitutions in these countries? Are they specific, peculiar, or do they represent a common problem elsewhere? Again, these are some of the issues I think we'll be talking about today. Eritrea's case, which was the subject of my paper, is peculiar for two reasons. First of all, the constitution drafting process was, by all accounts, at least by most accounts, said to be exemplary in terms of the process. All the elements for a good constitution-making process were there: transparency, participation of practically all stakeholders, society, and so on and so forth. Unfortunately, almost a year to the day after the ratification of this constitution, the powers that be in Eritrea that have supported the constitution-making process from the very beginning, indeed, they created the framework, the democratic constitutional framework for enabling the drafters to work, actually went back on their words. They decided to shelve the constitution. It's been now 1997. It's almost 15 years. The reason given by the government was the war that broke out between Ethiopia and Eritrea. But if that's the case, then the war had been over now for almost 9 years. So then why hasn't the constitution been implemented? So the fact that it has not been implemented in these last 9 years gives the lie to the excuse, the pretext. So that raises the question, why? When Mark Tachner says in his blurb, some successful, others less so, I'm afraid the case of Eritrea is in the category of those that were successful in the making, but in terms of outcome, not so successful. As the surgeon said in making a surgery, the operation was brilliant, but the patient is dead. That's the case in Eritrea. When I reflect on Eritrea's frustrated constitutional experience, what was a promising start, and the squandered opportunities, I'm reminded of that statement of the surgeon. Now, in all constitution making, there are three fundamental conditions that must be fulfilled. The first one, of course, is the willingness of a government, the commitment of a government to organize and attain the ideal of constitutional democracy. There was such a willingness at the beginning in 1997. The second condition was the public that is not only willing but able to attain such an ideal. The third condition is the entity, an entity that is able to fulfill a mandate, the mandate of constitution drafting, an entity that must be independent, that must be composed of people well-versed in the ideas and practices of constitution making. That, too, was fulfilled in the case of Eritrea. Unfortunately, the first two conditions, which are really related, were not fulfilled because the government went back on its word. And a public that are not supported by the government cannot very well fulfill its own mandate, because in the case of Eritrea, at any rate, there was no history of a public organized with the power to compel its government to fulfill its promise. Which raises the question, I think, among other things, what kind of values must be embedded in a constitution-making that will enable the public to compel its government to not to go back on its word? Obviously, in the case of Eritrea, there was no such value. There have been, in the short history of the colonial experience of Eritrea, 60 years of Italian occupation, 10 years of British occupation, and 30-odd years of Ethiopian occupation. There was a population that was suppressed, oppressed, and therefore a resistance movement which ended up in a 30-year war of liberation that eventually unseated the occupying army of Ethiopia. That was the condition. And that was indeed the condition that created the possibility that the Eritrean population, at least, was able and willing to fulfill the requirements that I mentioned. In other words, a population that had been oppressed by outsiders and that was liberated by its own people cannot be expected to do less than fulfill a promise of constitution making. I am quite sure that my friend and colleague, Professor Ndulo, and also Professor Pempe, will be giving examples of other parts of Africa. Now, the title of the event of today is Constitutionalism in Africa, Building the Foundation for Africa's Democracy. The objective of constitution making is to establish the fundamentals, the foundation for a democratic system. Now, in Africa, at the village level, there have been democracy, what in European and American history we call the Athenian type of democracy, has existed at the village level. We call it village democracy, you may call it Athenian democracy. But with the occupation of Europe, of African countries, these diverse groups were brought together, and the colonial state created a system, overarching system, that was imposed over different ethnic groups. Therefore, the village democracy would not be sufficient to accommodate the kind of democratic representative system that is expected in modern government. Therefore, obviously, African governments had to borrow from their former colonizers, in some cases even from America, to create a system that would, a representative system that would accommodate all the demands and needs of the different ethnic groups. Therefore, what we now call modern democracy, representative democracy, is a requirement. It's something which you cannot avoid. Some people question this. Some people say, why should Africa be constrained to accept an alien form of governance that was not part of its heritage? I think that is a false claim, because in its own way, Africa has had experience of democracy at the village level. The idea was there. Secondly, The idea of democracy, I think, has been with us now as a world community for at least 200 years. It is, indeed, the paramount political value of our time. Even dictators pay lip service to it. They may not practice it, but they pay lip service to it. I remember a few years ago when President Jiang Zemin of China came to visit the United States, being quizzed by President Clinton for not fulfilling China's obligations of providing human rights for its people. There had been claims of religious groups being rights of religious groups being violated, and when he made that point, I remember seeing a picture of Jiang Zemin smiling and saying, "That is a Western concept; it should not be imposed upon us." To which President Clinton said, "You are on the wrong side of history." Now, looking at the recent experience of President Obama dealing with the new president of Hu Jintao, I didn't see, I didn't hear our new president making the same statement that Clinton did. There seems to be some kind of shift in attitudes in view of the rise of China as a world power. There seems to be some kind of acceptance of the relative nature of what we now call constitution. The Chinese have their own way, therefore they must be left alone to do whatever they want. We cannot impose upon them what we claim to be a universal system. I don't know. Again, this is one issue I think we also have to discuss. Is Africa going to be told to abide by rules of law, the rule of law, and governance, democratic governance? Or can Africa claim the same, make the same claim that Jiang Zemin did? Don't impose upon us your own Western values. I doubt it. I think Africa has accepted the idea of democracy and the rule of law as a fundamental principle by which to live by. I think I'll stop there, and then perhaps I hope this will be taken up during question time. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to first thank the Institute for inviting me and also for the opportunity to participate in the process that led to the publication of this book. And I too would like to pay tribute to Ms. Miller for the wonderful work that she did in this project. Now, I'm not really going to go into detail in terms of my own contribution in the book, because I think that's available. So what I want to do is to try and share with you my, the lessons I could have learned from getting involved in a number of constitution-making processes. First, I think that when you look at the constitution-making process in Africa, you can divide it into three periods in history. First, of course, we have the pre-colonial independence constitutions. These are constitutions that were really negotiated, often between the political parties and the departing colonial power. This is what you have at issue in Kenya, it's the independence constitution in Zimbabwe, 1980. So this brand of constitutions followed a very different pattern in terms of development, the process that led to the enactment of these constitutions. And in fact, for those that are from the British tradition, you find that they're actually implemented by British legislation, because it's an order in council, which actually also gives independence to the state. So that's the first period. And these constitutions were largely, very centralized in terms of presidential power. And I think part of that, to me, seems to be heritage from the way the colonies were run, you know, with a very strong governor in each of the territories. So we end up with very, very strong presidents that have power and interfere in almost every aspect of government. And then, of course, we have the post-independence period. Unfortunately, I mean, we started with the not very good constitutions, but the post-independence period did not do much better. Instead, what we had is a campaign to mutilate these constitutions that were inherited from the British, if in the case of colonial Comoros, Africa, and you know, the French ones, and all that, in case of the French colonies. And you see lots of amendments which were directed at, in fact, making presidential power even more powerful. And if you take a look at, I think in my chapter I do refer to the amendments in Zimbabwe, you know, 20-odd amendments, all of them are focused on giving power to the president over other institutions. So clearly these are very unsatisfactory constitutions. And of course, the worst example of this is the Ugandan constitution, which is popularly referred to as the pigeonhole constitution, because the members of parliament woke up one morning, went to parliament, and found the constitution in each of the pigeonholes, and they passed the constitution. So that's the worst kind of example of that period. Now, then, of course, we have this post-democratization period, post-Cold War. And I think this period marks a departure from the way we made constitutions in the past. Here, there is an attempt to have a legitimate process. There is an attempt to be inclusive and to allow stakeholders, all stakeholders, to participate. And it's also very much influenced by the human rights developments internationally. I think that's the context in which this is happening. And here we have examples of the Namibian constitution, for example, the South African constitution, and, you know, many others. And now, with respect to Zimbabwe, of course, which was the topic that I dealt with, you then find efforts in 1999 to have a constitutional process, which ended up in failure because the constitution was defeated in a referendum. And I think the one thing that the Zimbabwean process in 2000 emphasized is the fact that the process is as important as the substance. Because there you see a process that began wrongly with the Mugabe appointing 400 members of the commission to an act of parliament, the Commission Inquiries Act, the process challenged by NGOs. In the end, when you look at the substance wasn't that bad in terms of the constitution that was adopted. That is compared to, of course, what was there. But the process had been wrong. And, of course, the NGOs continued to campaign against the constitution, and in the end, it is defeated. And where are we now? So then in Zimbabwe now, where we are, is that we have now a process that, I mean, is being governed by what is called the Global Compact Agreement, which was arrived at in 2009. And the idea in the Global Compact is, of course, creation of this unity government, but it is also an aspect of making the constitution. Now, I think there are problems, you know, in terms of how far that process has gone, and I think I would like to highlight three things which I think are kind of like missing and are going to be problematic as the process moves forward. One, there are no real timelines, you know, in the process. And here, I'm not saying that timelines solve everything, but I think when you don't have timelines, it can also be a real major problem. One of the, I've been involved in the Kenyan process more recently, and the, one of the good things I think about the Kenyan process is they had timelines, and this has kind of helped to push the process along. In the Zimbabwean one, there is nothing like that, and then the decision-making process is very unclear, and you also have a problem of there's no deadlock breaking mechanisms. When you have a deadlock, there is really nothing that is designed within the process to resolve that kind of deadlock. Also, in my view, and you can disagree with me there, but unfortunately, I mean, Zimbabwe has four constitutions, which they are starting with under the Global Compact. You know, you have the Lancaster Constitution, you have the Constitutional Commission draft of 2000, that's the one that was defeated, and then you have the National Constitutional draft, which is also available, and you have the kind of controversial Kariba draft. There are different opinions as to the status of the Kariba draft, and that's what I'm referring to when I say kind of contentious. Now, with those, they have instead of, I think they're looking at them, but then they've decided to go back to the kind of commission process. So the parliamentary committee is supposed to spearhead the process, but seems to be starting all over with going to visit the countryside, collect views, exactly what happened in 2000 and all that. Now, contrast that with the Kenyan process that realized that they've had a lot of these processes of consulting people, that there is data, there is information in terms of what you need. And the Kenyan process, if you look at it, with similar starting points, four constitutions too, you know, Wako draft, Bomas draft, and the rest, and the independence one. And they start first by looking at those constitutions and then harmonizing them to see where there's commonality and where there are differences, so that then you just begin to tackle the differences. You save time and money in the process. Now, what I would like to share with you, though, is more my the lessons that I have learned. First, in terms of decision-making, I alluded to this in the context of Zimbabwe. There is no decision in terms of how you make these decisions. I really think that in constitution-making process, you should try to have consensus. I think the problem with voting on constitutional provisions is that the losers don't accept the results, and they just strategize in terms of what how they're going to use that defeat to oppose something else. You know? So try to have consensus. And here I would say that look at the South African process. I think one of the beauties of the South African process was exactly that, they avoided making these decisions in terms of voting on provision. There was consensus building. Talk until you agree on a process. So that's one point I would like to emphasize. The other one I already mentioned, which is that process is as important as substance. You cannot get a good constitution if, in fact, the process was wrong. Now, the second thing is, of course, Professor Salasen mentioned this, the context. No two countries are the same. You should not go into Zimbabwe thinking you're going to draw a South African constitution there, or go to Kenya thinking you're going to draw a Namibian constitution. Look at the context. Look at the conditions. Those are very, very important. Now, it's also important to realize that in constitutional negotiations, the politicians on one side, and the NGOs and academics and other stakeholders on the other side, have very different objectives in terms of constitution making. And these are one of the lessons I learned, especially more recently in Kenya. That you see that the politicians are playing power games, in terms of how do we achieve power through this process. The NGOs that talk about values, constitutional values, and I think you must be aware of this as you move forward, so that you can actually deal with these issues. Third point, the question of inclusiveness. That, again, it goes to the first point I made about process and substance. And to me here, I always remember the words that Justice Mohammed, the first Black Chief Justice of South Africa, said that, a constitution must be autobiography, so that when any one person from that country looks into the constitution, they must see themselves in it. So it must be an autobiography. And I think that should be objective. in terms of inclusiveness, and of course try to get everybody into the process. Now, I think that also, to me, there is always a need to have an expert committee. And I think it's very, very necessary that you do have people that do understand what really you try to achieve in a constitution. And that is to avoid these huge constitutions that try to cover everything and things which should really be in legislation and not in a constitution. And also, the experts are going to help to convert public input into constitutional principles and have a debate. Now, I'm not saying that the experts should be have the last word, but there must be a factor. Somehow, we must structure the process in such a way that you have dialogue with people like that. Now, I also mentioned the fact that you have to have, deadlock breaking mechanisms. There are going to be differences in making a constitution. And the question is then, how do you break these deadlocks? And again, we can go into, in the question and answer session, we can go into examples. And I think here again, I would do four in this African process to say that, for example, you did have at the multi-party convention when they do the 93 one. And I think a lot of those principles were actually adopted in the final constitution too, is that you always had the negotiating council had somewhere to go in terms of the leaders. I mean, Mandela and de Klerk were never really involved in the negotiations. They were breaking deadlock mechanism. That's where you went when you were stuck. And of course, they had a larger picture of the process, and they would come and try and resolve that. So you have to develop also a culture of compromise. People have to learn that they have to compromise. You can't get everything that you want to get in a constitution. Now, we also, I think, have to realize one or two other things in constitution making, and that is that having a constitution itself is not the end. Now, we have to learn how to promote national values, which Professor Halase talked about, how to promote values that promote democracy, that promote constitutionalism. And here what I'm trying to get at is that you cannot legislate tolerance, for example. It is something that you must somehow teach the society and the community. They have to learn that. It's not something that you can pass in legislation tomorrow, people will be tolerating the opposition and tolerating their enemies and all that. No. It's a reflection that there is work to be done in the community. And the Constitution is the beginning, but we do need to move forward and do that. There's also a big problem in Africa in making constitutions in terms of the system of government that you want to choose. And here, again, this comes to light a lot in the context of the recent process or the ongoing process in Kenya. You know, if you look at historically, as I pointed out, in Africa, these colonial drafts that had, interestingly, most of the first constitutions in Africa actually paid lip service to the parliamentary system. They had prime ministers. But that was quickly changed to presidential. So we get the impression that Africa has always had presidential. Actually, that's not quite correct, including Kenya. I mean, it was prime minister, and then you change it to presidential. Now, I think that it is very, very important to understand that these two systems are different and call for different accountability mechanisms. Because there's confusion. So, for example, in one of the major problems in Africa in terms of excessive presidential power is the fact that the president is not accountable to parliament, because basically he controls parliament, where he gets his members of the cabinet, and parliamentarians are busy behaving because they're actually ambitious and want to be ministers. So somehow you have to realize that you have to adopt mechanisms that really are effective in ensuring that there's accountability if you choose the presidential system and if you choose the parliamentary system. Now, Kenya, for example, in the first draft, the November draft, the harmonized draft. They attempted to have a hybrid system because, of course, they couldn't decide. The experts felt that there was confusion within the country in terms of whether to go parliamentary or to go to presidential. And now, of course, the final draft, they've come out completely in favor of the presidential system and introduced, in my view, very innovative and good accountability mechanisms. But the point really I'm trying to make here is that you have to address that issue, and that issue must be addressed before you draft the constitution. That what do you want? Is it a presidential system? Is it a parliamentary system? And they're completely different ways of ensuring accountability. And here again, the best example is, for example, look at what happened after the Iraqi war to Bush and Blair. You know, Bush had a limited term, it continues. You know, but Blair couldn't continue because, of course, the parliamentary system, they can get rid of the guy. You know, so you have to really make a decision about that. And then again, you have to look at what kind of institutions are you going to put in place to ensure accountability. Now, the popular thing has, of course, to have the human rights commissions, which we now find in all African constitutions. You have the gender commissions and all that. Now, critical to all that, of course, is the independence of the judiciary. And I think that without an independent judiciary, you really cannot have accountability. We need a judiciary that are effective and independent. And that means that within the constitutional framework, we have to ensure that those things are in place. And of course, you do need other institutions, the question of the press, NGOs, and all the others. And I think they need constitutional protection. And lastly, the question of devolution of power. This is a critical point, because we should not look at devolution only in the context of creating subdivisions of government. It is an important aspect of accountability. And we must distinguish devolution, which is about devolving power and decentralizing the center. That's not the same thing. And a lot of what goes on in Africa is trying to decentralize the center without devolution. And devolution, I think, is very critical to ensuring that we do have different centers of power. We do have accountability. No one formula works on its own. And I think that what you need is, of course, a combination of all these things to be in place and to ensure that, in fact, that they are given the resources they need, and also the constitutional mandate to do what they're supposed to do. So that, for example, even when we talk about devolution, it has to be constitutionalized so that the president cannot try and interfere with that. I mean, I'll give you one example that is very common in African states. You find that whenever a subdivision government makes a mistake, the center dissolves it. I think that kind of power should never be there, because we don't dissolve the central government each time it makes a mistake. I mean, there are times when, I mean, there's a mechanism for accountability of the local system. They will face elections too, and they're about to make mistakes, and let them make mistakes. It's not a justification to dissolve them that they've made a mistake. But all those principles can only survive if they are constitutionalized. I think I will end here and look forward to your questions and comments on what you said. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Mendula.
Good morning. I will give a few comments about the Ghana process, and then just some general commentary on the African landscape as I see it in terms of constitution making and constitutionalism. Ghana's process was nowhere near state of the art. In fact, the Ghana process was hugely contested. In Ghana, the incumbent military regime, the Rawlings-led military regime, actually very closely managed the process from the beginning, set up a constitution, a commission of experts, which then developed a constitution, but following close guidelines given them by the government, including what kinds of things the government wanted to see in terms of structure. The government indicated a clear preference for a hybrid form of government. We got a hybrid form of government as a result. So there was a first, this constitution experts, a group of experts to draft a constitution, and then the constitution was delivered to a constituent assembly, the composition of which became hugely contested because the Rawlings government, consistent with its very populist trappings, essentially came up with a roster of organizations that would be represented in the Constituent Assembly and how many members each organization would get. It was structured in such a way as to minimize the role of the professional middle classes and the traditional elites, and amplify the role of the support base, the constituencies that form the support base of the Rawlings government at the time. So, for example, the Ghana Bar Association, which had staked for itself a long-standing monopoly in matters of constitution-making and thought it deserved a special place at the table, got, I think, one or two nominees. And the Association of Chop Bar Owners, which is those who in Ghana we call it chop bar, but these are like street restaurants, right? I mean, these are the nights, places you go in the night or during the day to just buy local food, you know, locally made food. We call them chop bars in Ghana. The Chop Bar Association, which nobody knew existed, had one representative just as the Ghana Bar Association. Right, but they were both bar associations. So the Ghana Bar Association boycotted the proceedings, as did actually a number of other professional groups that had historically had some significant role in these matters. Notwithstanding that, and of course the document that came out reflected the input of this Constituent Assembly. As it deliberated upon the draft constitution, and the result was then put to a national referendum, which passed overwhelmingly approved the constitution. Notwithstanding this defective process, right? Notwithstanding the contested process, certainly the Ghana, the outcomes in Ghana have been at least, relatively speaking, much more successful. We've had 17, almost two decades of unbroken democratic governments, notable for at least two political turnovers, one opposition government, opposition party replacing the ruling party in 2000, and the ruling party and then ex-opposition party coming back to power through hotly contested elections 2008. So you've had two turnovers under this constitution, the longest lasting constitution in Ghana's history of many constitutions. And in addition to that, you've had even though we had very closely contested elections, none has actually ended in the kind of strife that was visited upon Kenya after its elections. So Ghanaians commend themselves for having produced this outcome. And notwithstanding that, as I speak now, the country is going through another round of constitution making. So you ask why? Well, why Ghana? Ghana doesn't need to go through another round of constitution review. Well, I think that itself suggests that there has been, while Ghana has been very successful in the election front, in running very successful elections and in peacefully transition from one incumbent government to the next, the quality of governance, the quality of constitutionalism in the period between elections has certainly revealed, I think, certain continuities with the past. I mean, significantly, the persistence of an imperial presidency, pretty much, the president who essentially is monarch of all that he surveys. And the current process itself, the way in which it was initiated, I think lends credence to this view, which is that this current process was just initiated by the president, by executive order. The president just appointed a constitution review commission. That's it. No act of parliament, no consultation. The president just issues what in Ghana is called a constitutional instrument, essentially implying that sufficient authority for this is already conferred on the president by the constitution, and that's how the process began. Strangely, though, there has been almost no political opposition to this, nor any legal one. Actually, at the time I received the invitation to participate in this program, I was in the middle of co-authoring an essay, as we academics want to do, objecting to this process and suggesting that it was both constitutionally and from a policy standpoint improper. And yet we haven't been able to get anybody, even in the political opposition, to be interested in our argument. So there is a sort of national consensus that it is okay for the president single-handedly and exclusively to actually initiate a process of constitutional review to determine whether, when, who, and how this is done. And if the president appointed a 9-member body all by himself, he gave them a list of about 40 issues that have been flagged for the attention of this commission, and the commission is supposed to come up with a draft bill that would then be sent to parliament. In the interim, there would be consultations nationally throughout the country, and then the political parties will be brought in an extra parliamentary process at some point before it gets to parliament. Part of why the parliamentarians on the opposition side, or all of them, are not too concerned, is that there is a two-thirds, there's a supermajority requirement for passage of a bill to amend the constitution, and so the opposition probably believes that it has sufficient, at some point it would have a veto, essentially, if it didn't really like the process. And at any rate, the Ghana constitution is also very rigid. It is rigid with respect to what in Ghana, or in the common law tradition, at least in Africa, are called entrenched provisions, which are provisions whose amendment would require a much higher hurdle to clear. In Ghana, it not only must those provisions pass a supermajority in parliament, but they must also be approved in a referendum in which 40% of registered voters must have voted, and of those voting, 75% must have voted to approve the amendment. Now, it is difficult to understand why the Ghanaians would put themselves in this straitjacket. But among the theories for why this is so is essentially to make it difficult to amend one particular provision or set of provisions in the Constitution, known in Ghana as the transitional provisions, which are essentially immunity clauses for outgoing coup makers. Right. So the coup makers are essentially, after the fact, essentially admits to the illegality of their action, and on sometimes of the many of the actions that they took during the regime. And so at the end of each constitution that we've had, which has been a transition from a military junta to a civilian government, as an appendix to the constitution is attached this provision that has been called in Ghana transitional provisions. It's supposed to be transitional, but it's the most permanent portion of the constitution. And usually to protect that particular provision, the amendment procedures in Ghana have been just extraordinarily rigid. But for me, the idea that I find quite interesting from this current process is essentially, what do you do when you believe a process to be normatively defective, and yet there seems to be political consensus that process is okay, right? There is no contestation among the political class. In fact, those who have raised objections, even from the law faculty in Ghana, have raised objections about whether or not a constitutional review is desirable at all. Right? Not that the process is defective. Some have raised questions about the cost of it. But there's been very little talk about the fact that the president can determine if, when, how, and by whom the Constitution must be reviewed. And I think that in the larger context of the practice or the experiences in many African countries where after constitutions have been approved and are in operation, presidents have found it sometimes in their interest to want term extensions, right? And I mean, I think that the issue of who triggers a constitutional review must be something becomes part of the discussion. I mean, who is it that has the power to trigger a constitutional review when the constitution is already subsistent and it's already ongoing? And I think that leaving that power with any one organ, like a president, any one organ of state, certainly the president, is a real problem. Yeah, even where you have other obstacles down the line that the president must clear, I think that the mere fact that the president gets to trigger the process unilaterally is problematic. And part of this comes out of a common law tradition, certainly in Africa, where origination of all legislation is essentially almost the monopoly of the executive. And that long-standing tradition, and the fact that within the common law tradition too, constitutions are seen as just a special species of legislation. Right? So to the extent, in fact, I think Professor Ndolo referred to how most African countries got, most English-speaking African countries got their independence was by an order of council in Britain. In Ghana, there was the Ghana Independence Act passed in Britain, which enabled the Gold Coast to become Ghana. So there is, and that act embedded the Ghana Constitution in it. Right? So there's been this long-standing common law tradition of treating the constitution as just another species of legislation, and therefore if the president gets to originate all legislation, as in fact the Ghana president practically does, and not only practically, but constitutionally, the MPs in Ghana have conceded that there is a certain article in the constitution that disables them from actually initiating any legislation that would have even a de minimis impact on government finance of any sort at all. So because of that, the government has tended to control all origination of law. And I think that creates a problem. So this issue of who gets to initiate, for me, is one of the big issues to think about. Now, I think Professor Selassie also talked about this divergence between process and outcome that we are beginning to is becoming evident in many African countries that have gone through constitution-making processes. And here I think that one of the things that, in looking through a number of African constitutions and Ghana constitution included, I think that there is an issue that we have tended to often overlook, which is that constitution-making in the context in which we're speaking is certainly different from 1787 Philadelphia, right? I mean, we don't have the Philadelphia luxury of writing a new constitution, essentially creating or constituting a new republic on a clean slate, right? This is a going concern. The African states we're talking about here are states already in existence, right? So really, you do not have the luxury of reconstituting the state on a clean slate. The question becomes, what do you do with a pre-existing legal order? Right, the legal order that is still ongoing and on the basis of which the state runs all the time. How do you factor that into this new constitutional order, this new constitutional regime that you're creating? And I would suggest that, at least looking at the way in which it's been done in Ghana, is that historically there is a very hidden, almost unnoticed provision in the Ghana Constitution that, and it's in many of the African constitutions too, that give you the existing laws of the country as of the time, the date of the Constitution. The existing laws of Ghana shall include the following. And then there's the last, you know, part there saying, the laws of Ghana shall include the following. It delineates the laws, and then there's a last part saying existing law. Now, what that means is that we go into these new constitutional orders and constitutional regimes with all of the baggage of existing statutes and regulations from the pre-existing order that we're trying to move away from. And in fact, when you look at where these laws come from, it's really from the very early years of the Republic, right? Which is those years when the presidency was constituted. So in Ghana, for example, many of the laws that we continue to still use and on the basis of which the executive has most of its powers are not current laws at all. They're all laws from 1960s, right? So you have these laws that have been held over from all of the previous regimes, and if you have if you are a Ghana and you've had four or five military regimes in that intervening period, it also includes all of the decrees passed by those military regimes because they were laws, they were statutes. So our constitutional heritage, even when we have transitioned, or we thought we had transitioned from an authoritarian autocratic regime to a more democratic one, has always included this baggage of laws. In fact, the Ghanaian lawyers will tell you that most of the very good laws on the basis of which they do their practice in the courts are laws from the military regimes. The conveyancing decree, the lands transactions, all kinds of... There are a lot of laws in Ghana that go, and these go all the way back to 1960s, the first military coup. Even the law in Ghana now on the basis of which we register voters, that voters have a right to vote. The statute is actually it's a PNDC law. The PNDC is the Rawlings regime, Provisional National Defense Council. It is their law, not a statute of a democratic regime that has constitutional validity currently. What this it really raises a number of problems. The lawyers would say, well, this is these laws can you know, they are not. They remain good until they are tested constitutionally in court, and then they could, of course, be overturned constitutionally like any other law. The fact is that there is very little constitutional challenge being brought to any of these laws. Alternatively, they could be repealed by a subsequent parliament, which is a newly elected democratic parliament. And again, they are hardly ever repealed, in part because origination, even for repeal legislation, would have to come from the presidency, who tends to be the beneficiary of most of these old laws. So I think that in a way we have engineered our constitutional transitions in a way as to reinforce imperial presidency, at least on the legal side. One other thing I notice about constitutional processes that are currently going on in Africa is the extent to which we do not actually use this opportunity to take care of what I call the original sense of the founding period, right? There are a number of things that are almost closed cases in Africa. Federalism is still the F word in African politics. You know, notwithstanding all of the evidence that the centralized unitary state model has been a major disaster for a number of African countries, there has been very little revisiting of the issue of federalism, or if you didn't even want to call it federalism, or of a sufficient devolution of power to local government. Local administration and not local government still actually is what we have mostly in Africa. Local government, the local government is just a branch of the central government, essentially not any autonomous government of the people at the local level. So there is that problem that we continue to have. And we continue also to have a constitutionalism that marginalizes the role of traditional authority. These are institutions with a substantial amount of organic legitimacy at the local level, And for states that are usually very resource-strapped in their ability to manage the entire territory under their control, it seems to me a bit surprising that institutions that are there already and to whom the people essentially confer a great deal of social legitimacy continue to be grossly underutilized. And all of these things go back to the founding period. I mean, so the imperial presidency is a legacy of the founding period. The affinity for centralized unitary states is still a legacy of the founding period. Marginalization of any other kinds of elites at the local level is still a matter of the founding period. And I noticed that because we have tended to be fixated with reconstituting the central state, the structure in the central state, we have not paid enough attention to either, like I said initially, the other legal orders, administrative law issues of power below the presidency, below parliament, and the like. And we have also not revisited any of these closed issues, so-called closed issues from the founding period. I'm not even talking about redemarcating boundaries. We're talking about just how the state itself is constituted. So there's a great deal of continuity, actually, rather than change, in my view, in a lot of the constitutions that we see. The fight is usually over who gets power at the center and very little about how the whole enterprise of running a modern state would be pursued. There is also, lastly, I would note the, I think Professor Ndulu mentioned the rise of these new fourth branch institutions. If I'm not sure if it's a distinctive African contribution to constitutionalism, but constitutionalism has always been seen in the traditional historic Montesquieu tripartite form of government idea, but increasingly, in fact, there is a fourth branch of government emerging constitutionally in Africa. You have these human rights commissions, ombudsmen, anti-corruption agencies, all of which have actually a constitutional place at the table. And I think somehow, unfortunately, we've not really managed to come up with exactly how they fit into this scheme. Right, how they fit into this new constitutional scheme that we see enacted in many of these countries. One example from Ghana is that in terms of judicial doctrine, for example, the courts have had a great deal of difficulty trying to figure out what animals these four branches are, what exactly, where do they fit, even though they're supposed to be independent. When the Human Rights Commission has come up with a finding and an order against, say, a minister or a government official, what is the legal, what is the juridical status of that order that was given by this commission? The Ghana courts have treated it as nothing, so that if an adverse finding is made against you, you can come back to court and relitigate the issue all over again. You can start all over again in high court to relitigate your case. So we haven't still been able to figure out what to make of these new creatures that we have placed in our constitution for good reason, to do things that none of the three branches alone can do. And yet we haven't yet figured out, at least doctrinally, where it is that they fit within our constitutional scheme. These are some of my initial observations about the processes that I see in Africa and in Ghana, and I'm sure I'll have an opportunity to answer some questions later.
I'm going to make just a few points, picking up on some of the themes that the panelists mentioned in there. Really very interesting comments, and relate those to some of the broader points that emerged from the constitution-making study that's already been referenced. And I wanted to start by remarking on the point that Professor Selassie introduced and other panelists have also remarked on regarding this phenomenon of good processes that yield less than good outcomes. Bring in some examples of this from other cases that have been discussed today as well. And I think that this issue of good process and poor outcome relates to a broader question that's also been referenced briefly of the importance of context in fashioning a constitution-making process and in looking at the outcome of the process. And the question is, why is context so important? It really did emerge from the study as the overarching lesson that, you know, constitution-making processes need to be tailored to the particular context, and that the context really has an overwhelmingly determinative impact on what the results are. So why does context matter so much, and why is there so much variation in the results, even among processes that share a lot of similarities? Why are there so many idiosyncrasies in constitution making? And it's an important question because it relates to how we can go about designing and planning constitution-making processes in a way that maximizes the potential for good results. I think a general answer to this question or this set of questions is that even though we can look at constitution-making processes from a technical perspective, we can analyze them from a technical perspective and plot them out in terms of what good technique seems to look like based on experiences in many different countries, they are inherently political processes. They're about the distribution and exercise of power in society. In all of the 19 cases that are explored in the constitution-making book that's been referenced, political bodies played a role in the process. The role varied, the nature of the body varied. Some of them were elected directly, some of them were partly elected, partly appointed, a few of them were indirectly elected. But in all of the processes, a political body played some role, and in some cases, the principal role in the constitution-making process. For example, in South Africa, where an elected constituent assembly was the lead actor in the final constitution-making process. And, of course, elected bodies are necessarily political bodies, and the political dynamics within those bodies are not surprisingly going to trump the technical niceties of how the process is structured. Beyond the impact of elective politics or partly elected bodies on the process, there are other factors that can overwhelm the impact of the procedural forms, and some of them have been mentioned by the other panelists. For example, in the Eritrean situation, the behavior of the president is autocratic conduct overwhelmed the impact of the good process that was conducted there. There are other cases of where a process, while it may have some positive procedural forms, has been manipulated by an executive. For example, in Venezuela is one of the cases explored in the book, and that's evidence there, and also in the Ugandan case, which is Professor Ndula also referenced. And there are other cases where outside powers have played a particularly heavy role in the process and not always to good effect. And Afghanistan is one of the cases where we've seen some evidence of that. Whether the political forces that have an impact on the results of the process are internal domestic forces or external forces, their intentions about whether the procedural choices that are made are going to have their nominal or their potential effect have a very strong impact on the consequences. And to give you one more concrete example, one procedural mechanism that has often recommended, especially recently, and it's been discussed here too, for constitution-making processes is the appointment of a constitutional commission that can be broadly representative of different voices and institutions and society, can have included within it people who have legal and constitutional expertise, and can to some extent prepare a draft constitution in relative isolation from political forces in society. But whether a commission, even if on the surface shaped in a way that seems to check all of those boxes, actually has its intended effect is really depends upon what the intentions are of those who have established the process. So, for example, in Uganda, a commission was established that had good regional balance and gender balance and otherwise appeared to serve some important procedural purposes in terms of the form. At the end of the day, it was made up entirely of the president's supporters. In Afghanistan, a constitutional commission was appointed and attempted to do a professional work in terms of the preparation of the draft, but after the commission completed its work, the president's aides redrafted key provisions before they submitted the draft to the ultimate decision-making body, the constitutional lawyer jirga. And in some of the cases that have been mentioned here today, for example, in Eritrea, there was a constitutional commission chaired by Professor Selassie, which did excellent and highly regarded work, but the results were effectively set aside. Another answer to this question of why does context matter so much and why do we have variation between the quality of the process and the quality of the results goes to this question that's been raised of, or this point that's been raised regarding the necessity of having real consensus developed. Successful results, where we've seen them, have depended first and foremost on whether a genuine consensus underlies the constitutional text that's been developed. And sometimes it seems that whether there's a consensus there is actually more important than the objective quality of the text or the objective quality of the process that produced it. Professor Prempeh mentioned the experience in Ghana where there's been a sort of national consensus to go ahead with a process that is based on questionable legality as to the initiation of the process. There's another case study in the book that has a similar experience, and that's Colombia, where the process that's examined in the book was initiated by presidential decree, even though the then existing constitution required that only Congress could initiate a process. This issue went to the Supreme Court, which ultimately approved the presidential decree initiating the process on the somewhat spurious basis that it reflected popular sovereignty, because basically there was, in fact, some consensus in society and reflected actually in a referendum that was held to go ahead with the constitution-making process, even though the initiation of the process was contrary to existing law. In other cases, we've seen processes that are less than ideal in terms of the objective standards that many have applied to these and yet seem to have produced fairly good results. Spain, one of the earliest case studies that we look at in the book, is an example of that. The process there was often secretive, elite-driven, not participatory, not particularly transparent, not something that would be considered a model process today. But the text was, in fact, built on a real consensus about the country's direction and about the value of a transition to democracy. In South Africa, which did have a more ideal process in many respects, there was a long consensus-building process that actually preceded the final constitution-making and laid a firm foundation for that. And, in fact, the interim constitution there that was negotiated largely among elites in many respects prefigured the final constitution that was developed through a much more open and participatory process. Hungary is another example that we have in the book of a process that was far from ideal in many respects, was, again, largely produced by elites and is regarded as lacking in democratic legitimacy in many regards. And yet, you know, it's hard to say that Hungary is not an example of a relatively successful case of democratic transition and has joined the European Union and joined NATO. And again, I think we see that there was basically a consensus on the fundamental issues. So what some of these examples, I think, point out is that in looking at constitution-making processes and examining the procedures that are used, it's difficult to say, both on the basis of the case studies that are in the book and some of the examples that have been given today, as well as the limited empirical evidence that's available that tries to examine in political science terms, more rigorous way, some of these questions, it's difficult to say that process is really predictive of results. I don't think you can say that if you design and conduct a model constitution-making process or what appears to be one on the surface and in terms of the techniques that are applied, I don't think you can say that that will necessarily produce particular results. But I do think that we have evidence that flawed processes can produce distinctly negative results. They won't necessarily, as some of the other examples that I've mentioned indicate, but we do have examples of this, and I think this relates to some of the points that Professor Ndulo mentioned about the case of Zimbabwe in 1999 and some of the defects in the process there. Iraq is an important example in this regard that is explored in the book, where the flaws in the process really jeopardized the outcome of the constitution-making process, and in particular the failure during the process to include the Sunni Arabs fully and to ensure that their interests were well represented in the process contributed arguably to the country's slide into civil war during the 2006, 2005, 2006, and 2007 period. It's a case where the result is actually not so bad and may be close to what would have been achieved if there had been a more successfully inclusive process, but the process itself had some real downsides, and as I think it's an interesting comparison to the Zimbabwe case, where, as Professor Ndulo mentioned, the result actually was an improvement over the existing constitution, but the defects in the process had important negative outcomes. I think I'll stop there and leave plenty of time for some questions. Thank you.
Thank you to all of our panelists for the discussion that we have about 35 more minutes to continue. I wanted to just try and capture a few of the two themes that I heard, although one of them has to do with this idea of process, and I think, Laurel, you've captured it quite well, and both in terms of the key elements of it, but also the challenges. We had Professor Ndulo, who stressed that process is just as important as substance, which undoubtedly has to be true, and yet we have the case of Eritrea with a fantastic process and a poor outcome, and the case of Zimbabwe with a very poor process, or sorry, Ghana with a poor process, a defective process, and yet a relatively successful outcome. And then I think Laurel put the fine point on it when she, you know, context matters, And we need to be careful not to try to draw too broad a conclusion from any of this. The problem that we have as practitioners, the problem that we have as advisors, is we don't have a control. In this experiment of constitutionalism, there is absolutely no way of knowing which factor is actually dictating the outcome. There are just too many variables. The other theme that was raised and explored is this idea of constitutionalism in Africa. And again, I don't want to paint too broad a brush. People often point to South Africa as the most successful recent constitution-making experiment in Africa, and yet I would be wary of calling it African constitutionalism because, as someone who has advised on constitutions since South Africa's, we often look to South Africa as a model around the world. And so what does that tell us about constitutionalism, about African constitutionalism? On the one hand, we had Professor Prempeh talk about the reality that there is no clean slate in Africa, and undoubtedly that's true most places. Professor Nundulo talking about how the Constitution must be an autobiography, and indeed that must be true in most places as well. And yet, Professor Prempeh also spoke of the constitutions in Africa that marginalize the traditional and local governance. And to me, that's fascinating, and because there is, in fact, this history, this rich history, and this traditional governance in Africa that has, in many instances, been marginalized, and yet might indeed be the kernel of what could become African constitutionalism. And how do we tap into that as opposed to applying largely Western models that were created in the West for the West and trying to just use them as a template within Africa? And where is the tension there? Professor Selassie also spoke of a rich African experience with democracy at the village level, and yet also reminds us that the history of Africa with colonialism, but also just the fact that we today live everywhere within a global, you know, not just economy, but experience. And yet, so what is the, where is the distinction between local politics and global politics, and must this also be true for constitutionalism as well? So I just want to thank the panel again for bringing up these amazing themes and points and experiences. I think there are a lot of places we could take this. We have 30 minutes now. I apologize for using up five. For questions, answers, and discussions, we have two microphones, one on either side of the room. I would ask that you simply come up to the microphone. We'll take you in the order that you arrive on both sides of the room. Please introduce yourself. You can direct your question or your comment to a particular panelist or to the panel en banc. And I will leave it there. Yes, please.
I got here first. John Harbison, Johns Hopkins SAIS, and a former fellow here at the USIP. I really have two questions to pose. One is, particularly since Laura Miller talked about the importance of context, I'm really curious about the sampling procedure. How did you pick the countries that you did? I can think of a lot of countries in Africa, including Ghana especially, Benin, others that might, or Kenya, that might have been in the sample. So I'm curious about the sampling process. The second one is, I don't think Francis Deng is here this morning, but if he were, his book sitting out there on constitutionalism is a very important book. And Francis sits on two sides of a very important issue. He's the author, he's the progenitor of the idea of responsible sovereignty, which implies that we know what the ideal is, okay? And it's an international ideal. And that it's a question of holding governments in Africa and elsewhere, states responsible for holding those ideals or else, okay? The other side, which is reflected in his book out there, is, hey, look, and Professor Ndulo and Barak have both mentioned this, there are these traditional systems there, and Francis is very emphatic that those are alive and well and essential to the process. Okay, so I'm really curious how the book and the authors in the book sort of that dilemma. Thank you.
Thanks. Laurel, do you want to take the question in terms of how the case studies were chosen?
Sure,
and then for the second question, I don't know if the panel, or you
yeah.
as well, if the panelists were.
I can say a few words about that, and Barakat may have something to add to it as well. I mean, it was not a scientific process in terms of selecting the case studies. There were various criteria. One was that there was an interest in having geographic coverage, and we do have fairly broad geographic coverage among the case studies. There was a group of experts that a working group that Professor Selassie chaired that he mentioned earlier that was instrumental in helping to come up with the list of countries to focus on. And some of it was simply to look at countries where it was known among that group that there would be some interesting things to discover about process by looking at those countries. And also, there was an interest in looking at recent cases. And in fact, because the constitution-making processes in Iraq and Afghanistan occurred during the course of the project, those were added in because they were recent cases that it was known that they would be of interest to people using the book. There's also the cases in the book are not. They cover a range of different kinds of circumstances, but one of the main themes in the book and in the project more generally was to try to look at the relationship between constitution making and conflict resolution. And so there was an interest in selecting a fairly significant number of cases that that concerned post-conflict countries or countries emerging from conflict. And almost half the cases in the book focus on those. But there certainly is such a wealth of potential choices out there that even with 19 case studies, which is a lot for one book, it can hardly be said to be truly representative. In terms of the question of traditional systems, I would say it's one that's not touched on to any great extent within the book, but it might be interesting to hear what the other panelists have to say about that.
I would just invite you to...
Yeah, I mean, I agree that I think that the question of traditional authorities is very, very important, and that's one that I think we don't address in the book. And actually, even in the progressive South African constitution, it doesn't address that issue. And I think it's a failure in Africa, as my friend Brenda mentioned this, and it's kind of like a continuation of the colonial attitude. And I don't think it's that the African states don't address that issue. They actually continue to address it in a way that the colonial government addressed it, which is ignoring them and then using them when they want to. In my own country, Zambia, you find that when elections are up, then traditional authorities are very important because, they go to them because they want votes. After that, they are forgotten. And I think that in a recent book by Deng, in which I contributed a chapter on this, and I try to say that you can't wish these institutions away. So you have to address them. What role are they going to play? And one of the ideas I toy around with is trying to incorporate them at the level of local, local governments in a devolved system. And here I try to dwell on the Indian experience in terms of what India has done with, I think, what I will not get correct, but I'll try anyway. It's like pirates or something like that, these traditional institutions, which they have incorporated. So, as an idea, and I think it's important.
Yeah, on that issue too, I think that part of why we continue to marginalize or ignore traditional authority, I think it's that we think that we are in a new Republican era, right? We are a new era of republicanism in Africa, and that somehow chiefly authority. Because it lacks these Republican kinds of, or at least visible Republican trappings of electoral legitimacy, somehow do not fit in with a new system that is undergirded largely by democratic elections. And of course, I happen to believe that is completely misguided. But I think there's at least that excuse has been given me by a number of prominent elites in Ghana. But I really think that it's really just revisiting the colonial or at least the immediate post-colonial mistakes has been very difficult for African elites to do. I mean, at the founding, these were some of the institutions that were suppressed, partly because they were seen as having being favored by the colonial regimes, the expense of the modern educated elites. And in a number of countries, that was true. So at independence, that became payback. The elites now have power, and it's time to marginalize these groups. But I think it's also partly ties in with this, this whole fear of federalism, fear of local power, right? That if power is given to, far-flung places away from the capital city, that somehow the government could lose control. In Ghana, in the 2000 election, the opposition party promised that if elected, they would introduce the election of mayors. Mayors in Ghana are appointed by the president, right? So you sit in Accra, you appoint mayors for all of the many districts in the country. And the opposition party had made it's one of its campaign promises to actually push for the election of mayors. When it got to power, the president, of course, realized immediately that he would lose about 300 patronage positions doing that, right? So obviously that idea was shelved. And there's this fear of losing too much power at the center. And yet I think that unless that issue is addressed, or unless some form of local government is factored into African constitutionalism that actually really does give real some decision-making power to people at the local level to run their lives there, to raise some sources of income, to get back some of the monies that come from those areas actually to develop the capital cities. Unless we really do accommodate those interests, I think that African constitutionalism will continue to remain half-baked. And also it's important for the representation of rural populations. I mean, African parliaments are English-speaking parliaments for the most part. You have to be educated in many parts of Africa to actually have any say at all in these matters. And yet the chiefs are I think, the best bet for the rural, largely uneducated, pre-literate population, not uneducated, but pre-literate populations who are linguistically marginalized from participation in the larger governance. And then this becomes another layer of marginalization, I think, when we do not actually give some voice to those who they see legitimately as speaking in their name.
Yes, I think much of it has been covered by the two speakers. But just to add one, to emphasize one point, and that is one of the most important challenges facing African leaders in the post-colonial era was nation building. And giving power to traditional chiefs was conceived as contrary to that objective of nation building. It can be accommodated, in my view, this has been covered by Professor Brembe, by accepting the idea of federalism, or at least some form of devolution as a very important part of constitutionalism. If that is done, then I think much of the problems of contestation regarding the elimination or exclusion of traditional institutions will be answered. Ghana is a prime example of the Asante chiefs played a very important role in the anti-colonial movement. And therefore, there were Ghanaians who felt that Nkrumah did a lot of damage in excluding the Asantes, the chiefs. And indeed, the first person who overthrew him spoke about the need to restore our chieftaincies. Well, at the cultural level, I think African traditional institutions are very important. So we have to distinguish culture from politics. Traditional institutions are about power, mm-hmm. and the national elites are jealous of that power. That's all.
And if I could just add, I wonder how much of it is politics, how much of it is marginalization, how much of it is the history, the vestiges of colonialism, and how much of it is just a failure of imagination, that we have not figured out how to incorporate this aspect of governance into our traditional, I said it before, Western models. These local, these traditional governance systems, they don't They don't conform neatly to our territorial ideas of what local government is. They're not democratically elected in many cases, as Professor Prempeh points out. In many cases, bother our own ideas of egalitarianism, particularly towards women. And so we haven't figured out how to deal with them, and that may play as much a role into it as power politics and marginalization. Let me suggest that we take the four individuals, that we take a group of questions now, that all four of you get to ask your questions, and I'll put the burden on our panel to take good notes, and then we can address them over the rest of the time allotted here. Please.
Good noon, everybody. I'm Fahim Hashimi, a Fulbright scholar from Afghanistan, and currently I'm an intern in the Hudson Institute. I have two quick questions for the distinguished panelists. My first question is, in regard with the constitutional building in Africa, how has been the role of civil societies, particularly domestic political party pressures group or advocacy groups, and internationally the role of UN and human rights been playing, or these institutions has played role in constitutional building of, in Africa. Second question about the influence of politicians or authorities in constitutional building, as Ms. Miller mentioned about an example from Afghanistan. The constitution has been drafted by a special committee. When it was submitted to the government, it was changed, and then it was offered or sent to Lawyer Jirga in order to be approved. Well, how this bringing these changes in the long run will undermine the legitimacy of a constitution. To give an example from Afghanistan, recently some issue has been raised that some of the delegates who were in Loya Jirga constitution, Loya Jirga, they said we never passed this article, but now it exists in our constitution. And on the other hand, after the constitution was passed, President Karzai had brought some changes, and he announced that we just brought some grammatical changes in constitution. I wonder how this would undermine the future of a constitution. Thank you very much.
David Sroop from the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and in the 1990s, Senior Research Officer for Africa, the British Foreign Office. 4 points. First, as a former historian, I think it's often overlooked how important and how extensive consultation and debate in Africa was in the formulation of the original Lancaster House constitutions, or the Francophone equivalents. So if you take a country like Kenya, the whole of Kenyan political life from January 1960 to December 1963, during which time there were two general elections, was about the constitution. There was very extensive debate at all levels of African society, not only in Kenya, in Uganda, in Tanzania, in Nigeria, about the formation of the original constitutions. And that, I think, is often overlooked. The second point I'd like to make is we are all very fond of devolution. I'm not. partly because I come from a centralized state, but also because it has struck me that the reason why central government in Africa has acquired more and more power is that the most inefficient, the most corrupt sector of African governance is local government. Not the central state, but local government. And yet we are all, at the moment, heavily invested in devolving power to local authorities, which I think is likely, 10 years down the road, going to be seen as an overwhelming problem. The third point I'd like to make is about the role of oppositions in constitution making. Oppositions have vested political interests too. And I think the Kenyan case provides a very interesting example. That for the Kenyan have been debating constitutional reform now for the last quarter of a century. They have had a whole series of commissions. They've had a National Consultative Assembly. They have discussed a whole plethora of models. And yet, from November 2009 to May 2010, they've basically dumped what they had decided in the basket and come up with something very different. And that, I think, is a function of the opposition. The opposition in the 1990s and for most of the 2000s was against an imperial presidency. Now that Raila Odinga sees the gates of State House just down the road, he is not at all interested in having a hybrid state. He wants an imperial presidency because he recognizes that that particular section of the Orange Democratic Movement is likely to inherit. And then my final point, which I'd like you to comment on, and this is the most insidious thing I probably have to say to an American audience, is I come from a country that either doesn't have a constitution or has a very elaborate constitution in documents that have been devised over the last 1,000 years and therefore consists of hundreds and thousands of pages. But the constitution can basically be changed with a majority of one in parliament. There are no entrenched clauses of any kind whatsoever. We even until 1999 had an upper house dominated by unelected peers representing traditional authorities. But what seems to me, and we also don't believe in the separation of powers, unlike Americans. And what concerns me is that institutions like this, and institutions like the National Endowment for Democracy and IRI and NDI, they may not appreciate it fully. They may deny that they're actually doing it. But what they are involved with partly is the Americanization of African politics. And I think the present Kenyan constitutional proposals reveal that very clearly. And I think that that is totally unworkable. That it looks fine now, but in 20 years' time, we will say, why the hell did they copy the Americans? Why, you know, now we sit here and say, why did they inherit the Westminster model? Well, I prophesy 20 years down the road, the question will be different. And I think that in Kenya, you're going to have two possibilities. I'm not going to predict which. I think both are equally likely. That you are going to have an even more powerful imperial presidency and a totally voiceless legislature. Or alternatively, you're going to have a tremendously weak executive and an all-powerful legislature. What you need is to reconcile the two in, to quote a 17th century British concept, a mixed monarchy theory of government. And that seems to me the solution, rather than to adapt, which I think a lot of African countries are now doing willy-nilly, the American system. And then we need in the book to have had more Francophone studies. That's my final little comment, that I think the Francophone political experience is fundamentally different, as Jennifer Widener pointed out 20 years ago. And I think if there had been case studies of Francophone West Africa, we might have a different perspective than rather Anglophone-dominated.
Thank you. Perception. Two more questions, and then we'll get some answers.
Hi, Lozia Mahoney with the National Endowment for Democracy.
One of the bad guys.
I've just recently been in Zimbabwe, and I found that the common Zimbabweans, civil society, everybody in general, is very confused about the constitutional process. They're not sure if the Lancaster, the Kariba, or the so-called people-driven constitution. I would like to know from you if is anyway else democracy development practitioners in international donor community can put our efforts to something else to... Where can we put our efforts? Because it seems like the process is wrong from the get-go. Should we continue to push to this constitution and harmonizing it? Will it work? Another question is on Angola. I know it's not one of your country studies, But the country recently, early in the year, approved a new constitution that only consolidated the power of the presidency. My question is decentralization or devolution of power in a context of Angola would help easy or smooth the transition to democracy?
Thank you.
Norman Fulton, Metro State College of Denver. Thank you all for your time. Professor Nadulo, and as well as Ms. Miller, commented on the need for consensus in the process. I just would wonder how that looks practically when you have one side who tends to refuse to compromise, and how what's that look like practically? How do you deal with that side that refuses the compromise? Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for your questions and comments. I feel like I've been proven right. The attendees are as spectacular as the panelists. It's usually my experience at these events. I'm going to allow our panelists a few minutes. We are short on time, but we'll go right down and allow you to cherry-pick the questions that you feel you could want to respond to. So, Professor Selassie.
I will leave Afghanistan to Laurel. I will begin by answering our British friend. The only point I agree with you on is on British. Your last remark about the omission of the Francophone Africa. You're absolutely right. We were wrong. The other comments are bunkum. Absolutely bunkum. You are a historian, and yet you pretend to be a prophet. Thank you. Well, I'm entitled, this is a free country. I'm entitled to make comments like that. To begin with, Lancaster House, when the Kenyans were in London negotiating the constitution in Lancaster House, I happened to be, by one of those interesting coincidences, to be in London. And Tom Boyer happened to be one of my friends, and I followed the events closely. There had been no discussions in Kenya that I can remember. And so the British advisors devised the constitution for the Kenyans. The Kenyans tried to negotiate them down, and they had to accept because they needed their independence. And that's pretty much the case in all other Lancaster House models. Thank you very much.
Professor Ndu.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I'll try to be quick and brief. First, in terms of civil society, I think civil society plays very, very important role. As I pointed out, in my view, I mean, you have really like the dynamics of the politicians trying to power politics and, you know, the other groups, especially civil society, focusing on constitutional values. And I think that that's why it's so important to make sure that the process is open to everybody so that you can take advantage of that. On the question of the UN, what role and all that, I think, again, here, we should forget that the modern constitutional making is taking place within a context of the human rights culture, you know, where these countries have also subscribed to international conventions, you know, on social economic rights, on political rights, and all those are factors. I think the role that the international community plays is to give best practices, you know, because as we see from the studies, these problems are not unique. I mean, you know, in Poland, in Zimbabwe, you know, everywhere. So at least you should be able to point out to say, look, you know, there is this practice over there. This is how they handle this issue and that kind of thing. So I think that's a major role. But I'm against international players taking the lead. You know, the process must be owned by the people. If you want to destroy a process, go there and start lecturing to people that this is what they should do and that kind of thing. They just won't take it, you know. And I think it's right not to take it. On the Zimbabwe, I think the problem with Zimbabwe was 1999, I think the question was raised, was the process that we all refer to, you know, that it was appointed, the huge group, 400, appointed by Mugabe and all that, and clearly that was wrong. I'm not a fan of, you know, the these commissions, you know, because I think that they can be manipulated, which often they are. And, you know, when you collect lots of testimony, I mean, anybody can find support for whatever they want to do, you know, in a document like that. And that's true. I mean, I was in Kenya in November when we were dealing with this. They had 1 million responses, you know, to the constitution. And the experts are supposed to evaluate those in 2 weeks. So I don't know. I mean, they said they did, but, you know, yeah. Now, the Lancaster process, I don't agree that it was consultative because, you see, I mean, these were negotiations. And the, also, it's not really a condemnation, for lack of a better term, of, say, the British process or whatever. The point was that that period, that was not a period of human rights in the world. I mean, you know, this was really what was going on in the world. And I think, as the Premier alluded to, you see, the American Constitution was made by just a group of men, you know, somewhere. You can't do those things anymore. I mean, you know, they happened those days. But today, it's a different world. You know, you cannot employ the same methods. So I don't think the process was consultative. Devolution and local government, well, local governments are corrupt. You see, the thing is that, don't forget that when you create devolved states, you also have to create capacity, you know, for them. What is really at issue is not the devolution, it's the capacity. I mean, if you just devolve power to some district which has no capacity, no trained people, nothing, of course you're going to get problems. No one is saying once you devolve, the answer is there. But you have to do other things too to ensure that this thing works. The Odinga story, I completely disagree on that, you know, because here I really have personal experience. I've been involved in the Kenyan process from 2008. I attended the Parliamentary Select Committee. Actually, Odinga wanted the Prime Minister system. It is Kibaki who wants the presidential system. And that was a concession from the ODM. And actually, Odinga got into trouble for conceding that thing because the ODM people were beginning to rebel. They wanted a parliamentary system. So for me, that's news to say that Odinga wanted presidential, because I actually was in the meeting. So I saw that. Now, the Americanizational process, I don't see it that way. You see, for me, you have to go to the people. Let's ask the Zimbabweans, what do they want? Now, these people have wide experience. Zimbabwe is not composed of people just trained in UK or trained in America. You know, I mean, it's like the way the whole human rights process has been appropriated by, say, World Bank, saying that they introduced this in Africa. No, when I was teaching in Zambia, we used to agitate for human rights. And even when the World Bank was telling us that, no, this, we are not involved in politics. So we own the process. You know, it's not a process that is owned by just one group of people. It's not just an American thing. You know, go to the people, find out what they want. And that's, I think, and they're entitled to take lessons from anywhere. Yeah, so on the consensus, I agree. It's a difficult thing. But you know what? I think this is why you see leadership. That leadership is so important. And that's the one thing that we forgot about, you know, the whole process. That you can have all these things, but if you don't have leadership, somebody who really wants the process to work, somebody who has a big picture, I believe that one of the biggest problems in Zimbabwe is leadership. I mean, Mugabe is not going to deliver, period. And if you contrast that to, say, Mandela, who had a big picture for the process, or de Klerk, now they all wanted to see the process succeed. And I think that is important, that the leadership in any situation is critical to what progress you make.
Thank you very much. Professor Prempeh?
Americanization and African politics. I think it would be, I'm not particularly sure why it's African politics only. I mean, there is all politics, actually. The last British elections were run as though it was a presidential election. I mean, I think since Margaret Thatcher, I think one could fairly say that the British have moved towards a de facto presidential form of government, notwithstanding the trappings of Westminster. So it's clearly the one institution in American constitutionalism that is definitely being universalized is judicial review and the role of courts. That's fair to say, but that's not just an African phenomenon. It's a fairly global. And I think it's also misleading to think that merely because a country chooses a presidential form of government, that somehow it's leaning towards an imperial presidency. In fact, the most imperial of presidencies in Africa have been produced by the hybrid forms. the hybrid forms of government, which actually persist in most African countries, have combined the most executive-minded elements in presidentialism with the most executive-minded elements in the Westminster model. And in fact, in Ghana, we have a hybrid. In the Francophone countries, after 1958, they all chose the hybrid French model, the De Gaulle model, which is really still what pertains in most of them. Angola has a hybrid. Most of these countries have hybrids. So if you want to explain the imperial presidency in Africa in terms of constitutional design, I think the hybrid form actually bears more blame for the outcome than does the presidential form per se, notwithstanding the name. So I think it's not quite correct to suggest that merely because, for example, Odinga would want a presidential form of government means that he's probably leaning towards a more imperial presidency than the hybrid form. The hybrid form has actually been very bad in terms of the imperial presidency. With respect to local government, I don't even believe that there's been local government. Like I said, you know, Africa's experience has been one of local administration, not local government. Africa hasn't had local government in the post-colonial period or in the colonial period. So the failures of local government, including the corruption in the institutions of local government at the local level, are failures of central administration. These people who work at the local level are not part and parcel of the local community for the most part. They are representatives of the central government sent there on posting from various parts. They work for the central ministry. They don't work for the people down at the local level. So there hasn't been any local government to speak of. And therefore, I think that blame again for the results we see, the inefficiencies, whatever corruption we see at the local level, could not fairly be blamed on local government. It's local administration, which is when you run a local system as a branch office of the central government, that's what you get. Pre-colonial traditional institutions were known to have all kinds of guarantees against chiefly abuse of authority. Again, there's a wide variation from the Buganda to the Ashanti to Oyo in Yoruba and all those places. But at least among the Ashantis, for example, chiefs were routinely removed. And among their countries are known to be destitute. They are routinely removed for corruption or for any violation of an injunction, one of the many injunctions that come with their offices. So again, I think that it's not a fair comment to suggest that what failures you see in local administration are local failures of local government.
Try to be fast. I'm going to try to rally to the defense of our questioner on at least one point. I share some of your concerns about this enthusiasm for devolution or decentralization, or it has some other names as well. And I don't make that comment based specifically on anything that's going on in Africa, but more broadly, when you look at the role that the international community is playing, the UN, US, and others, in nation building and state building around the world, there is quite an abundance of enthusiasm for the idea of devolution. And it seems to be that the impulse is, well, if you've got a corrupt or a weak central government, well, the answer must be just to devolve power to the local level. And somehow, by being closer to the people, it all will be better. And I really haven't seen any evidence to suggest that that's the case. This is a case where I don't think it's an Americanization problem, but really I think the Europeans have been more in the forefront because of some of the European Union values that have been transmitted into this broader international work. And I've been doing some work recently in Haiti, and this is an issue there as well. There's a lot of talk about decentralization there, and that, you know, this is the answer to the problems the Haitian government. Well, if there's lack of capacity at the central level in the Haitian government, there's a whole lot less at the local level as well. So what are you going to get just by pushing authority down to the local level, especially when there isn't a lot of resources there? On the question that the gentleman from Afghanistan raised about undermining the legitimacy of the Constitution through some less than proper procedures, I think it's a situation where time will tell. There have been cases where constitutions can accrete legitimacy over time, regardless of exactly how they came into being. And really, fundamentally, I think in Afghanistan, as in other places, the question is, you know, is this a constitution that's going to be, in reality, implemented and respected over time and become embedded in the political culture in a way that will enable it to gain legitimacy over time? If those things don't happen, then some of the flaws of the period in which it came into being could really continue to reverberate. And on the last point, the question about developing consensus and what do you do when some participants in the process or people outside of the process refuse to compromise, it's a real problem that's come up in a number of cases. South Africa is a case where they did achieve compromise and consensus over time, but worked at it very hard over a very extended period of time, and it certainly wasn't a foregone conclusion at the start of the process that it was going to have that result. And I do very much agree with Professor Ndula's point about the importance of leadership in overcoming those obstacles. And there are also cases where refusals to compromise are not overcome. The Colombian process is one in the book in which some essential parties never did participate in the process and never did agree to it. It went forward anyway, and opportunities were created for them to be involved in political life later. The Bosnia case that we have is one in the book is one where there was never any real compromise among any of the parties, but international pressure was such that a constitution was forged anyway and is in effect papered over the lack of compromise, and there are still some continuing problems as a result of that.
Thank you very much. I want to thank everyone for joining us today, especially our esteemed panel. We could be going, we could talk for another hour, but we'll have to wrap it up.